This morning, my paper, while we're looking at the print ministry, I don't want to give the impression that I'm just going to give an overview of their print ministry. That's been handled by people like Brian Stanley, Daniel Potts, and other scholars, but I'm going to focus in on a specific principle that guided their print ministry, so a specific principle that determined what they put into print. And so it helps you to see what came out in the periodical accounts and other material that the reading public in Britain, as well as America, received. So a better title to my paper would actually be The Principle of Selective Representation of Fuller and Ward, Promoting a Guarded Image of Baptist Missions this morning. And in doing so, we're gonna feel a bit like an accordion when you, I think, leave the room. So I'll give an overview of Ward and then focus in on how he perceived himself and his primary contribution. And then I'll pull back a little bit and look at this principle that guided Fuller and Ward in their material, their printed material, and then focus in on one particular instance where things went a bit awry. Okay. At Segur Island, mothers were seen casting their living offspring amongst a number of alligators and standing to gaze at these monsters quarreling for their prey, beholding the writhing infant in the jaws of the successful animal, and standing motionless while it broke the bones and sucked the blood from their poor innocents. Such was the grotesque and heart-wrenching scene which William Ward described. He stepped into this scene and was inseparably linked thereafter. It was a land of infanticide, self-beheadings, and drugged immolations of widowed women, all of which were meant to placate local deities and seek their blessings. It was also a land in which William Carey had lived for nearly 6 years with very little evangelistic results. Something more was needed. The Baptist Missionary Society determined to send a printer to disseminate Carey's translated scriptures. Ward received this honor. In this paper, we'll look at an agreement between Andrew Fuller and William Ward to abide by a specific principle that guided their ministry of print. They chose to selectively represent a carefully guarded image of Baptist missions in their publications, a principle that failed, however, under the weight of their disagreement over communion. So Ward's brief biographical sketch. William Ward, born on October 20th, 1769, was the son of John Ward, a carpenter and builder in Derby, Yorkshire. William's father died when he was a small child, leaving his mother to raise him alone. Initially influenced by a Quaker gathering at Derby's town hall, Ward's mother began to regularly attend the local Wesleyan Methodist chapel and appears to have been a truly Christian woman. It was to his mother that Ward attributed his first impressions of religion and eternal matters. This foundation would soon support an eventual life of piety and a missionary career that would last over several years. At age 13, Ward received his first employment opportunity at John Drury's paper, The Derby Mercury. Drury found Ward to be more than he expected when accepting him as an apprentice, and hired him for an additional 2 years with increased responsibilities at the paper. It was during this time that Ward increased his interest in political and social reform. And this is a very interesting aspect of Ward's life that Christopher Smith has explored in detail in the mid-90s. But the BMS, you know, the political climate of the 1790s was very volatile. And the BMS was on the edge at times as far as dealing with missionaries such as Grieg and Fountain and Compere. And then William Ward had this social reform and political reform background as he comes into the consideration of the BMS for missionary service. As the horrors of the French Revolution circulated throughout England, reformed societies began to drown under the swelling tide of loyalist sentiment. But Ward was not one to scuttle his convictions so quickly and be quiet. He increased the intensity of his political activism, actually, narrowly avoiding imprisonment on two occasions because of his radical publications. He did not possess a fervor that pushed him to sustain sedition or outright rebellion, though. Rather, he was simply a politically and socially aware individual with a slight taste for activism. His path out of this uneasy love affair with activism coincided with his deepening relationship with Darby's Particular Baptists. This transition, which occurred between 1791 and 1797, eventually led Ward to pursue vocational ministry. Describing this chronologically vague stage of Ward's life, Samuel Stinnett, his fellow student at Ewood Hall, his close friend and his first biographer, wrote, "The time, however, was now drawing near when his religious character was to be more fully developed and his energies directed to more important objects." It was time for Ward to put his former self to death and embrace fully the Particular Baptist faith. Therefore, he received baptism by immersion on August 28, 1796. Just a year later, Ward began studying for the ministry at Ewood Hall in Yorkshire under Dr. John Fawcett. Fawcett was a respected theologian with an established reputation for advocating Baptist missions through printed pamphlets. This environment proved to be ripe for Ward to mature in a way that would combine his developed talents with his newfound vocation. This rare combination soon caught the BMS's attention. Over the preceding years, Carey asked Fuller on several occasions to send a printer, one like Ward, to work with him. Ward and Carey had actually met several years, or right before Carey left for India, and he always recalled that meeting and had asked for Fuller to send him a printer like the printer he met in Derby, which, referring back to Ward. In the fall of 1798, John Sutcliffe approached Ward about serving the society as a printer. After a short time of consideration, Ward wrote to Fuller, who then presented him as a missionary candidate on September 20, 1798. He satisfied the committee's requirements and was appointed to go to Bengal the following spring. It is somewhat amazing that Ward received this appointment so quickly in light of his widely known political radicalism. BMS representatives were in no mood to allow flexibility on this issue, as they had dismissed Jacob Grigg from missionary service only 2 years prior and were currently battling a resistant John Fountain. In such an uneasy climate, the BMS accepted Ward as a missionary printer despite his politically charged past. Undoubtedly, when the BMS committee met with Ward to examine him, they made full inquiry into his political principles and history. And the BMS resolutions at that Kettering meeting actually give great insight into that. That's in the Periodical Accounts, Volume 1. And they made full inquiry, the text reads, into his character, principles, and qualifications. His character and qualifications were exactly what the BMS wanted. His political principles, however, required further consideration. Fuller would not waste the opportunity to set the tone for what the BMS expected politically from Ward and the other newly appointed missionaries. He stated, "One circumstance is of so much consequence that we must not omit it in this parting address, though you have been again and again reminded of it individually, and we have reason to suspect you are otherwise minded than ourselves." And so there you get that they recognize that Ward was not necessarily on the same page on this issue. "Beware, however, both from a principle of conscience and from sound policy and regard to your own interest and that of the mission, to keep at the utmost distance from intermeddling with any political concerns." Apparently, Carey's pressing needs trumped obvious concerns related to Ward, thus creating an option that might have been unimaginable otherwise. Ward never dropped his social and political concerns to the degree that Fuller would have liked, but he refrained from advocating political or social action apart from spiritual transformation throughout his career. So now his time in Bengal. Despite a hurried approval process, Ward departed for Serampore in May of 1799, carrying strong affirmations from Fuller, Fawcett, and Samuel Pierce. Ward arrived in Serampore, India, on October 14, 1799, after this five-month journey aboard the Criterion, piloted by an American Presbyterian, Captain Wicks. The attractiveness of Ward's printing capabilities drew Carey to Serampore in early 1800, And 2 months later, Ward produced the first proof sheets of Carey's Bengali New Testament. Ward's character and abilities so impressed Carey that he wrote to Fuller, "This is the very man we wanted." By the close of the 19th century first decade, Ward's print business was outfitted with 10 presses, employed by 200 natives, and manufactured their own paper to reduce costs. The print business was so successful that Ward reported to churches supporting the BMS that the press covered between 43% and 50% of the society's global expenses per year. Ward's contribution at Serampore thus provided much-needed income for the society's expanding operation globally. Over the years, Ward became an indispensable leader in other areas among the brethren at Serampore. He would become a deacon and eventually a pastor of the Serampore and Calcutta Baptist Church, thus receiving official recognition for his long-standing role as a leader among his peers. His leadership increased at Serampore through his preaching, writing, and supervision of junior personnel, as Carey spent large amounts of time teaching at Fort William in Calcutta. As an author, Ward became the primary one responsible for relaying information from Serampore to the West. He authored the Missions Covenant and other such works that directed the Serampore Brethren. Finally, he was also instrumental in leading the Serampore mission through very dark times during the anti-missionary movement of the British government, the growing strife with younger missionaries in Calcutta, and the changing BMS leadership following Fuller's death. After a respite in England to restore his health and the mission's relationship to the BMS leadership in England, Ward returned to Serampore in May of 1821, carrying a large sum of donations for the new work, the Serampore College. His health failed less than 2 years after landing in England, thus cutting short this final stint of his ministry when he died on March 7, 1823, to cholera. Such was the evolution of Ward from a potentially suspect missionary candidate to a stalwart member of the Serampore Trio, without whom success at Serampore became unthinkable. Now, his primary contribution, the Darby printer. Within his 24 years of faithful ministry, Ward had a specific understanding of his role in the society. He was first and foremost a printer. His assignment was to print Carey's translations. Barely aboard the Criterion, he opened his journal by stating his calling. "Blessed be God that I am now on board a vessel which will, I trust, carry me to India to print the New Testament. Unto me, who am less than all the least of the saints, is this grace given that I should print among the millions in India the unsearchable riches of Christ." A few years later, Ward continued to see this role as his primary contribution. After stating several trials he recently endured, Ward stated, "Yet this is the great thing. We are printing the word of Jehovah, the word which is not to return void, but is to answer the purpose for which it is sent, that is, to be the power of God to salvation for those who believe, and the sanctifying word to all Christ's true disciples." He knew that these labors were not ill spent, as he recorded, "Scarcely a day passes, but one or other comes to get a New Testament or some pamphlets." This contribution would not fade with the passing years, as Joshua Marshman would note in his funeral sermon for Ward. So in that funeral sermon, Marshman actually records that he saw, when they were aboard the Criterion, the journal entry of Ward that I referenced or that I quoted earlier, that he primarily saw his ministry is going to be a printer. And Marshman then expands that quote and says, "But how could he have imagined that he would have printed the Bible in over 20 languages?" Certainly, the effectiveness of his print ministry in Bengal far exceeded Ward's initial hopes. Assisting in translating and personally printing the scriptures in one new language per year of missionary service had to pass the wildest expectations of this Derby radical printer. Over time, Ward came to understand that his ministry included far more than simply printing Carey's scriptures. He began to see himself as the primary source of information for Fuller's missions advocacy to BMS supporters. Fuller used his journals and personal letters as foundational material for the periodical accounts. The Kettering editor then built upon this base with material penned by other BMS missionaries. Ward received consistent reminders from Fuller concerning the vital importance of this correspondence. For example, Fuller wrote on August 1, 1801, "I beseech you, do not shorten your journal. Your talent is to journalize. I understand more of the mission from those daily statements of things as they occur than by any other means." In 10 letters that I've found from Fuller to Ward, he states the same sentiment, that it is from Ward that he understands the happenings on the field more than any other source. In another instance, Fuller cherished the receipt of Ward's journal so much that he stayed awake until 2 a.m. reading with delight until he finished the entire correspondence. He indicated thus when writing to Ward, "How welcome are your letters, and especially your journals. The last, which arrived with papers, took me 6 hours to read. But though I began it at 8 p.m, I left it not until I had finished. And the blessing of the Lord, which has attended you in the printing, in circulating of your papers, and in conversing with the youth, rejoices my heart." Years later, Fuller continued to speak similar words of affirmation to Ward concerning the value of his correspondence. Fuller thus enabled Ward to expand his perceived role to include content other than printing the scriptures alone. These warm remarks from Fuller to Ward would not inspire the latter to continue this contribution, as he stopped journaling and greatly reduced his personal correspondence with supporters in England. He began focusing his energy on what he thought to be a more productive effort. He began a monthly newspaper called the Circular Letters in December 1807. Rightly, he understood that he could relay news to the mission's Western supporters at a faster rate, with less effort, and at a lower cost through the circular letters than through his handwritten journal and personal letters. Also, he came to see that he would have complete control over the message and image portrayed to his Western readers, which was a growing problem for Ward, as discussed below. It seems that he felt tension over dropping his personal journal. How could he abandon completely such a valuable tool of ministry? But by early 1811, he completely forsook journaling to focus on his work as an author and pastor in Bengal. As time wore on, Ward's adjusted print ministry, especially his work on the Hindus and his farewell letters, furthered an existing level of respect among his Western readers. His influence as an image bearer for BMS missions, however, looked much different with these decisions. Ward's circular letters proved to be a poor substitute for his former arrangement with Fuller. As the original generation of BMS leadership passed to the next, along with Ward's decision to invest more deeply in Bengal, his print influence thus decreased in Britain. And Ward, Fuller has sent a letter to Ward expressing how difficult it was to actually get a complete copy of his circular letters. So they would all try to get together the BMS leaders in England and put together and make a whole copy, but it was very difficult to even do that, working together. One can see a shift in Ward's ministry as pastoral responsibilities in Bengal grew and his primary attention became dedicated to raising up leaders among Bengali Christians. After he altered his print relationship with Fuller, Ward's primary point of significance in the Western context changed to become that of a highly regarded missiological model with a reduced level of personal interaction. The question before us at this point concerns how Fuller and Ward worked together in such a way that enabled Ward to be so influential in the West. Their selective representation, the Fuller-Ward principle. One must grasp this principle, the principle that offered guidelines for the material Fuller published in the periodical accounts. The private dialogue between Fuller and Ward became public knowledge only after an editorial sifting by Fuller's pen. These two BMS leaders agreed to abide by such an arrangement early in Ward's missionary career. Fuller and Ward thus entered a mutually agreed upon principle. They would carefully represent the BMS image to their various audiences, the principle established. It appears that the copy of Ward's journal sent to Fuller was always intended for public use, while personal letters were meant for public viewing under very limited circumstances. So his journal was much different than Samuel Pierce's intended use, as we heard yesterday. Ward's early letters and journals held very little back, and Fuller felt the need to encourage him to be more discerning. Fuller wrote, "I have full confidence in you and your colleagues that you will not go into anything of this kind," referring to a business proposition, "but what you judge necessary, nor entangle yourselves for the sake of worldly appearances. We are somewhat grieved, however, to learn that Sister Ward should expend so enormous a sum for a straw bonnet and send the account back to England. Were such a thing generally known here, it would do the mission great injury." Eventually, Ward came to understand the immense value of holding to the principle of selective representation. In 1805, he wrote to Fuller, "When you put the periodical accounts to press, be careful that the freedom with which I write you, exposing the secrets of the mission and the relative state of things betwixt us here as brethren in the same work, take care that the utmost delicacy be observed." In an earlier letter, Fuller expressed the same concern. "Your journal, my dear brother, also those of brethren Marshman and Brunston, are very interesting, but your now and then dropping a hint of a private nature to me renders it improper to send it out of my house." According to these letters and other pieces of correspondence, one can confidently say that Fuller and Ward were mutually committed to this principle of selective representation by the end of 1805. Therefore, their agreement brought about a filtered perception for readers of the periodical accounts. Now, naturally, Fuller was expected to edit the material received from the mission field to correct grammatical and spelling errors. This was his job. His responsibilities also included summarizing unnecessary details before putting such material to print. At times, however, he portrayed what he wanted missionaries to do and be rather than what they did and who they were. This process resulted in the occasional addition and omission of particular details that reveal more than simple editorial work in certain circumstances. The principle applied: additions. A comparison of Ward's journal to the periodical accounts reveals specific additions to the original text. Fuller created an idealized William Ward and other Serampore missionaries to champion the BMS cause. In some ways, Fuller fell into a standard 19th century practice of writing hagiography. For instance, a self-described melancholy Ward was further plunged into emotional struggle when sisters Marshman and Grant argued with one another. One can sense Ward's longing for eternal release from the effects of sin when he concluded that day's entry. "But God made it up. We had a most precious prayer meeting. I was much melted in prayer, as well as our brethren, and we longed for nothing so much as for that later day glory." Fuller, however, skipped the disagreement between the two women and changed Ward's concluding remark. "We seem to long for nothing so much as the spread of our Redeemer's kingdom." Several entries in Ward's journal, such as this one that displayed emotional struggle or an occasional bout against sin, faced expected revision under Fuller's oversight. He preferred to focus on the gospel's forward progress through Ward, not his struggles. In another entry, an obviously agitated William Ward became an otherworldly saint in Fuller's hands. After describing Calcutta in very scant detail, Ward wrote, "Sometimes I'm disgusted with the view of our situation altogether, the weakness of our sisters, the speedy loss of our dear Captain Wicks, the clashing of discordant tempers now and then, the want of government sanction, the obstacles in the way of success. Yet I most feel willing to concur in divine purposes, be they what they may." After Fuller finished his edits in this entry, the Calcutta scene was bursting with beautiful colors, serene scenes of peaceful Indian life, and an abundance of choice foods. All of this with only one thing missing, as stated by Fuller's imagined Ward, or created Ward, I guess you could say. "Oh, if the Christian virtues could be planted in their hearts, this would indeed be a paradise." It seems that Fuller could imagine an idealized William Ward in an idealized India from several thousand miles away, but the disgusted Ward of reality had to confess trust in God's providence through his clenched teeth. And as we heard yesterday, Ward had a deep sense in the providence of God, but he was also one to express very real and raw emotion. In other places, Fuller added interpretive sentences to either make the text more interesting or offer a theological evaluation of the recorded events. On one such occasion, Fuller apparently added a comment to Ward's journal concerning Grant's evangelistic encounters with the Criterion's cook. In an entry a few weeks later, Ward discussed other sailors aboard the ship. Ward said that they were less willing to listen to the missionaries concerning religion than they had been earlier in the voyage. He wrapped up this entry on a positive note by adding remarks concerning two of the sailors' progress spiritually. Fuller published this entry with a less optimistic ending. Yet it is very difficult indeed to write the plan of salvation on their minds. So prone are they, with all men, to expect salvation from their own efforts. And here I think you see Fuller importing a lot of what he's dealing with, what he's been dealing with over the years. If you think of the context and his writings against the deists and Thomas Paine, and his works against natural religion, and throughout the periodical accounts, you'll see these kind of entries where he speaks against that. He'll insert these comments that aren't in the original text that I think he's pulling over that conversation, that debate with the deists, and then that blossoms obviously into the whole anti-mission movement in the first decade of the 19th century. And so you have that whole conversation going on. That's the context there, and then you see Fuller inserting these kind of comments, talking about man's not able to create religion or salvation on their own efforts. Fuller thus took an opportunity to state theologically why the sailors displayed a diminished interest in the gospel. In such instances, Fuller clearly added remarks that would evoke his desired response. The principle applied concerning omissions. Not only did additional material trickle into Ward's journal entries, but readers will also discover specific omissions at various points. While exact motivations for such exclusions are unclear in some places, they fall into three general categories. At times the decision was one of intentional deletion. Fuller and Ward believed that their evangelical supporters and broader audience would react negatively to certain details. For instance, Ward told of a dispute that occurred between two of the missionary women over a three-day period, which included Sister Grant's refusal to reconcile in the matter. Evaluating the incident a few weeks later, Ward saw the gospel's effects on reconciliation and strengthening relationships. Fuller excluded the entire matter from the periodical accounts. On another occasion, Fuller chose to leave out Ward's account of charges brought against Mrs. Marden before the other Singapore missionaries for her excessive drinking. Although not nearly as scandalous an affair as it would be in certain Baptist circles today, Fuller believed it to be unhelpful to the BMS image nevertheless. Such instances were deleted rather than potentially allowed to fragment a growing support base. In other cases, some material proved unworthy of going into the periodical accounts. It became the second category, unnecessary details. At this point, it appeared that Ward was the primary one responsible for these edits. He reduced his longer entries to an extract that he sent to Fuller. These extracts excluded information regarding weather, food purchases, and other similar matters. Some of this reduced material made it to the periodical accounts, but most of it proved insignificant. Finally, a third category regards the certain entries that were omitted by either Fuller or Ward for reasons that are unclear. A specific illustration was Ward's decision not to inform Fuller of William Grant's death. In this situation, the copied version of Ward's journal that Fuller received did not include details that Fuller deeply desired on this matter. Although Grant died on October 31, 1799, Ward continued to leave out these details in the journal that Fuller received. One should not think that Ward was unaffected by Grant's death. Simple disregard was not to blame. He lamented, "How unsearchable are God's judgments, and his ways past finding out." Recovered from the depths of infidelity, Grant promised to be a useful missionary in the hands of our Savior. He could command many weighty arguments in favor of Christianity. I know not when any death so much affected me. The infidelity of my heart says, surely, if God means to convert the Hindus to Christ, he would not cut off his instruments on the threshold of their work after they have come 15,000 miles on such an errand. Despite such pain, Ward felt no need to inform Fuller of this tragic news. Rather, he chose to sift details of Grant's death through his own filter. This exclusion was an example of Ward's editorial work that was somewhat defined and at times confusing. Fuller expressed his disbelief concerning Ward's decision to withhold information on this matter. This choice puzzles modern readers as well. Why would he leave out such vital information regarding one of the society's newly appointed servants? The only explanation for such edits seems to be Daniel Pott's evaluation that Ward simply lacked judgment as to what should or should not be printed, a problem that haunted him in England in his radical printing and followed him to Bengal at times. Ultimately, the arrangement that Fuller wanted was a businesslike report on the mission's happenings with vivid detail. He would decide at that point what should or should not go to their readership. Thus, Fuller and Ward were committed to this policy of representing the Serampore mission to BMS supporters in a selective way. This policy led them either to add or delete certain material for the mission's greater health. At two points, this commitment was put to the test under very serious circumstances. One of these situations, the blame for which laid solely at Ward's feet, resulted from an evangelistic tract printed at Serampore's press containing irreverent terminology regarding Muhammad, so very fit for today. Potential war between the British and Denmark loomed over the matter, and the British missionaries faced the sobering reality of deportation or even imprisonment. This incident violated the apparent progress the BMS experienced to that point to avoid political involvement. While Fuller reported this incident in the periodical accounts, he did so with extreme caution without relaying the severity of the events. The other test was one that lasted over a decade. Differences over the proper recipients of communion would try their principle of selective representation as well as the depth of their friendship. Each one of these issues reveals, or both of these issues reveals, the justification of this Fuller Ward commitment. Both men were aware that officials in the British government were reading the periodical accounts to gain information that would aid in the anti-mission movement. Thus, the need to avoid any hint of material that undermined British interest in light of the previously mentioned political climate of the 1790s. Also, casting doubt on the BMS commitment to certain particular Baptist doctrines would certainly hamper British evangelical support for the society. Therefore, Fuller felt pressure to satisfy two completely different audiences, secular government onlookers, as well as the evangelical support base. Otherwise, the BMS image would be tarnished or even shattered. For the most part, it seems that this principle of selective representation worked on many thorny issues. One will find very little negative feedback tracing back to the periodical accounts. But did it work in all situations? So the principle of selective representation applied to communion. Fuller and Ward never agreed on the permitted recipients of communion, a topic which commanded at least some space in approximately 20% of their personal correspondence. Their disagreement was not important enough to break their close friendship, yet Ward's thoughts were serious enough to not pass Fuller's filter. Ultimately, their principle of selective representation would fail under the pressure of this topic. Serampore's sifting communion. When the newly appointed missionaries Ward, Marshman, Brunsdon, Grant, and the accompanying wives stepped onto the Criterion, they faced several challenges, one of which was celebrating the Lord's Supper. Barely 2 weeks into their journey, the missionaries had to work through the problems of not having an ordained minister to oversee communion. Also, they had to ask whether practicing the Lord's Supper was permissible because they were not in a constituted church. Although the others favored moving ahead, Joshua Marshman objected to approaching the Lord's table on these two grounds. His objections were short-lived as he consented to join his brethren only 5 days later. Once they resolved these questions, the missionaries then came to a view of open communion in order to allow Captain Wicks, a Presbyterian from Philadelphia, to join them at the table. Before accepting the missionaries' invitation, Wicks actually raised questions as relayed by Ward. Wicks wondered whether it were not contrary to our discipline to admit him, and whether we had not sacrificed something to oblige him. But we satisfied him on this subject. Of course, Fuller skipped over this material when choosing selections from Ward's journal for the periodical accounts. He ended the sentence before and picked up the account again with the sentence directly following the summary of Wicks. Wicks would not have found such a general reception in India, however, as Carey was unwilling to allow non-Baptists to participate in the Lord's table. Carey, who joked about the young missionary's mixed communion on board the Criterion, was ready to debar Wicks from the Lord's Supper on September 6, 1801. Wicks was expected to be on worship, to be at worship on that Sunday. Carey fully prepared to inform him that their church order did not admit of mixed communion. Although Carey scolded the young missionaries for practicing mixed communion, Ward was not swayed so easily. He countered the former cobbler with his joyful memories of uniting with Wicks at the Lord's table. At this point, Fuller would have been very pleased with the correction of the new missionary's temporary failure. Succumbing to ecumenical communion was unbefitting for a particular Baptist missionary and unworthy of attention in the periodical accounts. On May 31, 1805, the Serampore missionaries agreed to shift to mixed communion. Ward offered an account of their decision to allow Pado Baptist at the communion table. At this meeting, it was unanimously resolved that this church would permit to occasional communion those persons of known piety who should request it, though in our opinion they are unbaptized. Such persons must first give timely notice of their wish and must be approved of by the church. They would only be permitted to sit down at the Lord's table without having anything to do with the affairs of the church. So open communion, but closed as far as membership. This alteration of church rules has not been affected by my arguments, though I should think it an honor if it had. Mr. and Mrs. Brown seem to have set Brother Marshman a-thinking upon it, and Brother Marshman converted Brother Carey, and our new brethren have gone into it cheerfully. All our sisters seem to have been previously on the amiable side of the question. I rejoice that the first Christian church in Bengal has shaken off that apparent moroseness of temper which has so long made Baptists appear unlovely in the Christian world. I am glad that this church considers real religion alone as the ground of admission to the Lord's table. With respect to a church state, a stricter union is required. But to partake of the Lord's Supper worthily, it requires only that a man's heart be right with God. The Serampore brethren, therefore, did not make this decision under Ward's compulsion, but rather by working through the question over time. In fact, Ward was willing to bow his convictions to external pressure, carry strict communion in this case, in order to avoid too much controversy, which was a trait that was consistent from his radical Darby editorials to the end of his Serampore career. One can see how flexible Ward proved to be on this matter, as he was the one who informed Fuller and the other BMS leaders regarding their decision. The joint statement from the missionaries used language found throughout Ward's journal and earlier letters to Fuller. Fuller, of course, was not pleased. "I have been this week selecting and arranging materials for the periodical accounts and have left out all that you have written about mixed communion. How could I otherwise? Are you not off Christian growth and wandering in the mazes of carnal reasoning? How much sweeter and better are the other parts of your communications?" And I think this is typical of Fuller. "Well, I will think of those and try to forget the other." Ward did not allow Fuller's response to go unchecked. "Let men be first of one heart, and then there is hope that they will soon be of one judgment. That it is the duty of all saints to hold communion together at the Lord's table is as clear a truth to me as that all men are sinners. If this not be the spirit of the whole New Testament, I was never in anything more mistaken." The two men would spar in this way through their personal correspondence until Fuller's death, but such communication never found its way to the periodical accounts. Their principle of selective representation held firm for the moment. Eventually, Fuller would win the day in the Serampore doctrine of communion, although Ward's conscience remained unconvinced. Marshman informed Fuller on August 31st, 1811, that the Church of Christ at Serampore has restored its primitive and scriptural purity in the point of communion, and I think it is not very likely soon to lose it again. And Marshman on this issue is a really fun figure because he's wavering back and forth more than anyone. And, you know, he's holding to this principle. 5 days later on the Criterion, he succumbs to mixed communion. Then he goes back to strict communion under Carey right when they land. About 4 years later, he comes back to open communion. And then in 1811, he's, you know, extolling this restoration of scriptural purity. The Serampore Church would retain this position on communion for the remaining days of Fuller and Ward. Ward gave up the fight, as he stated to John Ryland in 1815. In this quote we heard yesterday, that the brethren are mistaken in this point, and that they should not perceive that such a practice is a violation of the law of love, but I throw away the guns to preserve the ship. Although Ward obviously submitted to Carey and Fuller on this matter, he never relinquished his personal convictions. In his farewell letters, published after Fuller's death, Ward called open communion Christian communion. He was shocked to find no Baptist churches in America practicing Christian communion. And he even encountered a few ministers who did not hesitate to avow that they did not consider paedo-Baptist as in the pale of the visible church. He found it strange that the Baptists, who were so severely persecuted in Boston, should themselves act in a way that was so utterly contrary to Christian forbearance and charity. Ward was willing to sacrifice his understanding of communion at the beginning of this 16-year conversation. Fuller was concerned with selective representation to keep this matter from the reading public. Therefore, most BMS supporters had very little, if any, knowledge regarding the disagreements over communion at Serampore. Within this broad understanding of the matter, questions remain concerning the actual views of Fuller and Ward. So Fuller and Ward on communion. Regarding communion, several issues emerged over the years that were common points of disagreement between the two men. First, Ward's great hope was that Christ would bring all his people into one body. Ward asserted this view in several letters to Fuller, as well as his journal. Fuller responded that oneness in Christ would be accomplished by the Lord bringing disciples into one mind with himself. He had no room for sacrificing biblical points of disfellowship. A second point of contention was Ward's guiding principle for embracing mixed communion. He held that God only requires a man's heart to be right with him to receive the Lord's Supper. He stated, "Do not the bounds of scriptural communion extend to all who are real Christians, except that they have embraced immorality or dangerous heresy." Ward's thought was unsatisfactory to Fuller on this connection of repentance, baptism, and communion, or one might say his separation of the three. He admitted that repentance should be connected with baptism. He did not see the essential connection between baptism and communion. Ward believed that a particular church should examine the potential communicant and determine if he exhibited a genuine faith. Validation, therefore, rested with the believing community's determination of spiritual signs of fruit to the possible exclusion of identifying with Christ through baptism. Still, one must not misread Ward and think that he brushed aside this ordinance. He argued simply that a connection between baptism and communion is not any closer than the connection between all of the other ordinances. All right, so he saw more ordinances than just these two. Therefore, a strict communionist should refuse to pray, an ordinance, with paedo-Baptist in order to be consistent. In Ward's view, the scriptural command to take the Lord's Supper applied to the Baptist and the paedo-Baptist alike. If Christ commanded his followers, misunderstanding of valid baptism set aside, to take communion, what Baptist could actively undermine a paedo-Baptist attempt to be faithful? Fuller saw Ward's interpretation of this scriptural pattern as completely off. Fuller agreed that immorality and heresy should make one ineligible to receive communion, but he added a third disqualifier: omitting or corrupting worship as instituted by Christ in Scripture. For Fuller, Scripture laid out the order in which one must partake in the ordinances. To do otherwise would be a violation of God's prescriptive commands. According to him, Ward's reasoning had been so influenced by paedo-Baptist thought in his paedo-Baptist relationships, such as Buchanan, as we heard yesterday in one paper, as paedo-Baptist thought, that he had succumbed to one of their greatest flaws, confounding moral obligation with the positive institutions of Christ in Scripture. Ward should not consider prayer and singing to be ordinances. They are rather moral obligations. If they are ordinances, then wards should celebrate the Lord's death with unbelievers, as much as he is willing to sing and pray in their presence. Therefore, Ward held to a completely inconsistent line of thinking in Fuller's evaluation. Ultimately, Fuller's problem with Ward on this point was his argument that baptism is not essential to church communion. From his earliest attempts to correct Ward's assertions, Fuller understood this issue to be Ward's primary justification of mixed communion. It was also his most inconsistent argument for the practice. Fuller's deciding factor to exclude paedo-baptists was the pattern set out in Scripture, but felt that Ward failed to grasp this biblical pattern. Another point of division was Ward's inclusion of paedo-baptists as exemplary figures in his pamphlet on open communion, and also his earlier form of agreement in 1805. Ward asked Fuller how he could refuse the ordinance to such evangelical greats if they were to attend his worship services. Fuller gave his answer through a Fulleristic edit. He erased Wesley's name from Ward's list of great evangelicals. That was how Fuller would handle such nonsense. He said that he would not have communed with Wesley even if he would have been a Baptist. Some of Fuller's close relations who knew Wesley believed him to be a dishonest man and depicted him as a crafty Jesuit. Fuller considered it an impossibility that genuine Christians could hold Wesley's position on salvation or sinless perfection. How could someone claim to know either himself or the Savior and espouse such perspectives? Also, including Owen, Watts, Edwards, and Doddridge in his argument proved nothing. Ward's use of their names was a feeble attempt to add weight to his assertions. Besides, scriptural teaching remained the greatest source of validation in Fuller's mind, not respected individuals. Probably the most repeated claim by Ward regarded the law of love. He asserted that strict communionists violated this law by debarring paedo-baptists from the Lord's table. Ward saw the connection between baptism and communion as a matter of one's conscience before the Lord. Fuller replied that he held not this position as an unloving stance toward other men, but rather as an expression of love unto God. Again, to honor God according to his revealed precepts guided Fuller to lovingly require of men what God declared to be good and true. Certainly, Fuller was not one to compel another's conscience, but the one who disagreed on this point should exercise his freedom to receive the elements elsewhere. And it's very interesting to follow Fuller and Ward on their interpretation of Acts 2, 1 Corinthians 10, and the Lord's commission, and how they understood the relationship between baptism and communion. Fuller held that you should go and teach all nations and baptize them. And those two were connected, as in the Lord's Great Commission. Ward saw that the teaching could take a while, and then the baptism. So he was still pushing paedo-baptists towards baptism, but he was willing to allow a bit of time there before a person came to that position. Two factors appear to have shaped Ward's willingness to allow unbaptized Christians, in their views, to approach the communion table. First, one must remember Ward's early religious experience within the Methodist fold, and also his respect for the Moravians. so he had deep respect for other evangelicals. He seemed to retain his deep respect for that group, the Methodists, throughout his life. Therefore, he was committed to a broad ecumenism from his earliest days as a believer. Second, Ward may have been slow to require baptism before communion in all cases because of his immediate context. Doctrinal niceties do not always translate so easily to the chaos of the mission field. For natives to receive baptism when Ward's early letters were written meant that one lost caste, and therefore they were completely ostracized. Fuller saw baptism as the distinguishing badge of Christianity by which men were to be known, acknowledged, and treated as members of Christ's visible kingdom. This may have been the very thing Ward wanted to avoid in his early considerations of the ordinances. Whereas Ward's first expression of open communion involved the Presbyterian wicks, his thinking quickly, and I do mean quickly, came to include potential native converts on the field. Whatever the early influences may have been, by 1809, Ward held to a fully developed defense of this position in his writings to Fuller. As much as he disagreed with Fuller on this matter, he also seemed to have rejected the application of their selective representation principle to this issue. Ward was ready to ignore Fuller's encouragements to embrace strict communion, as well as his desire to keep this serum pour discussion quiet. When Fuller repeatedly used his masterful skills as an editor to reject Ward's material on mixed communion, the serum pour printer utilized his greatest asset. He went to press. Apparently, the news of Ward's mixed communion did not gain enough traction in the West to demand a response from Fuller until late in his life. Communion thus became a rare example of an issue on which Fuller and Ward never agreed, and to which their principle of selective representation eventually failed. Even so, it was not one that damaged the BMS image to the degree that Fuller anticipated. Conclusion. Through his godly example, writings, and pastoral oversight in serum pour, Andrew Fuller's good friend, William Ward, led the BMS effort to extend the kingdom of Christ throughout Asia. It was through his print ministry that Ward had his greatest impact. Fuller and Ward believed that this impact would be positive only if they abided by a principle of guarding carefully the image portrayed to the public. Therefore, the periodical accounts were dead silent on matters that had the potential to destroy their work. This agreement of selective representation, however, failed on one point of contention, the strict versus mixed communion. Ward was willing to abide by such standards for barely a decade before bypassing Fuller's editorial missions. Fuller always looked to Ward as his best source of information, despite this perceived indiscretion. Fuller believed the BMS cause would have floundered without this invaluable printer turned missionary. Unmovable was the partnership between an elephant from Kettering and a somewhat recovered radical in serum pour. One point of failure aside, they abided by this agreed-upon parameter to guide their printed ministry material and offer a specific image to their audience. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I have quite a bit of material of that in my footnotes, but felt that I wouldn't have time to get to it. Fuller was always wary of their relationship with Buchanan and Brown and other Episcopals in Calcutta, and he warned them on several occasions to avoid these relationships or at least be cautious. And Brian Stanley, in his second chapter on the history of the Baptist mission, he talks about that Fuller was afraid of these relationships because he felt that if they continued to progress in those relationships, they would eventually succumb to Episcopal desires. And he saw according to Stanley, and I need to think through this a bit more. I'm not sure that I agree with Stanley so much, but according to Stanley, he saw that as a political tool. According to Stanley, Fuller saw that as a political tool in India in a way to undermine and undercut and completely scuttle the Baptist mission. So Stanley argues that he was guarding the Baptist mission and warning them against those relationships. Fuller and Ward both agreed that it was through paedobaptism that all the heresies and all the dangers that the Christian church has ever experienced came through the early embrace of infant baptism in the early church. And so they were both in agreement that they should avoid those getting so close that they succumb to those doctrines. It's a very interesting thing. But they the serum pour missionaries loved the Episcopals, Brown and Buchanan. And as your paper talked about yesterday, they really all worked together to capitalize on the growing sentiments and the momentum of Christian missions, the modern missionary movement, And they all really worked together in many ways to both extend the gospel in India and also to represent what was happening there to increase their support base in the West. Yeah, it's a fascinating set of relationships. Yeah.
Yesterday we were talking, you had some interesting things about you feel like maybe Fuller intentionally suppressed the evangelism that Kerry had with Muslims.
Yeah, I'll do that a lot in my dissertation, so I don't want to go too much. So no one, any quick writers in here would undercut me. But the I would say probably maybe 10 to 20% of what was actually written by these people and sent back to Fuller concerning their ministry to Muslims made it into the periodical accounts. So, Timothy George and other historians of the Baptist Missionary Society, they really give the picture that their ministry was mainly to Hindus. But when you look, they had a preaching circuit that they all agreed to try to get to each month of 200 Muslim villages. So they were out preaching specifically to Muslim villages, and really their first mission station, their first vibrant mission station was in a Muslim territory, Jessore. They had a very vibrant ministry to Muslims, but very little of that made it to the periodical accounts. I think, and I need to flesh this out more over the coming months, but like I said in my presentation, I think a lot of that was because Fuller was, you only have so much room in the periodical accounts. And so he was putting in there material that was what he was dealing with on many fronts. So this whole idea that the Hindu nation was a virtuous place and the Hindu people, virtuous people, and we should leave them alone, and that whole rhetoric of the anti-mission movement, he's countering a lot of that, and really focusing in on their ministry to Hindus in the periodical accounts. So you do see some of that material in the periodical accounts, but very little of it actually. Yeah, it seems that the subscription base was not as wide as the periodical accounts, and it just wasn't as successful. It was hard to get the material in the West, and I'm not exactly sure why, Fuller and these guys wouldn't push that as a way. Fuller loved it. It took a couple of years for Fuller. He repeatedly talks to Ward about how he needs to increase the quality of his circular letters, but by the end of 1809, you see things in there, this is kind of this conflicted Fuller, where he still wants him to continue journaling and sending back material the way he used to do things, but he's also seeing the value of the circular letters. It just seems to be a mixed bag. I think as Ward was trying to hammer out what this operation would look like and the material that should go into it, Daniel Potts talks about how uninteresting Ward was as an author, and I agree. If you read the material of Ward in the circular letters, the earlier letters, it's very dry and it's really hard to go through. It's a lot. Well, I won't say that, but it's just really dry. But the quote that I opened with, I hope you all found that very interesting. But that comes from his farewell letters, which was written late in his life. And it was the material that when he came back to England and to America, to Europe and to America, that's the material he used when he went out to churches. And then the farewell letters is it's an unexplored thing, but you can get on Google Books and read it. It's fascinating. And that the chapter that I drew that from is just full of probably 10 to 15 such accounts. And it's really hard to actually read that chapter. As I was reading through it one night, I told my wife, I don't think I can read anymore because it's just infanticide and these beheadings and all these horrible things. Now, he obviously learned, Potts, when he's talking about how dry and uninteresting Ward was as an author, he was talking about his earlier days. He obviously progressed quite a bit, so that gives us all a little bit of hope, right, that we can continue. All
right. Anyone else?
No hard questions at this point.
I think
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure Fuller, you know, that he expressed the majority view in that regard. But he certainly was wise to warn them. I have a very lengthy footnote in here that talks about the problems that came to the Serampore Church and the Calcutta Church through their views on open communion, particularly Ward's stances, and just the problems that created. So Fuller was wise to warn them, even though I think it was a minority perspective there.
That was really good.